sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Draghi drop. Yep, here to stay. Markets rejoice. We have a jam-packed programming note to follow and lots to talk about at the world at large. All this and much more on episode number 367 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome, Andrew Horowitz here, and it is the, June 8th, the week of June 8th, starting in 2014, episode number 367 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And again, we have lots to talk about today. Thanks for joining me. And thanks for all your emails last week. That conversation that we had with Frank Curzio definitely struck a chord when it comes to the shale plays, natural gas, some of the oil discussion we had. And I want to thank you. Of course, you can email me at any given time to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So as I mentioned, we're going to have some great programming coming up. Just some absolutely terrific names that are going to be coming up in the next 3 or 4 weeks. We have Dosk, old friend of ours, coming back. What we wanted to do, he and I talked a little bit about the recent discussion that the ECB is going to a negative deposit rate and some of the things that they did. And we wanted to, we both decided that, you know what, let's wait a few weeks to find out exactly how this all settles in, how the markets react to this before we do our discussion, because right now, this is something that's very unprecedented, something that really we haven't seen before. And how the markets react to this is going to be very interesting. Already we've seen that the euro, which initially dropped in all these measures, came right back up and, in fact, was a little bit higher the same day that the announcement was made in the morning. The euro actually closed higher than when the announcement was made. Very interesting. So we're going to have him on. We'll talk about that. We also have Jim Bruce coming on. And he is the director of the movie Money for Nothing. Now, this is interesting because this is a movie that was done back in about a year ago. And it is an independent, nonpartisan documentary that examines America's central bank in a critical yet balanced way. And it's narrated by actor Liev Schreiber. And it has interviews with Paul Volcker, Janet Yellen, Jeremy Grantham, and plenty of great financial minds. And this is an independent movie that was put out. You can see it in some theaters around, but listen to the trailer that I put up for you. We'll put the trailer on the site as well, but I want you to listen
to
this.
One of the president's most important appointments is chairman of the Federal Reserve. The Fed is the symbol of the integrity of our financial system. And the decisions of the Fed affects the lives and livelihoods of all Americans.
I think we're mysterious to people. I think they're not sure what we do.
The Fed is a sometimes very independent organization.
Every Federal Reserve chairman says one thing and does another.
It's a bunch of government workers trying to fix prices.
The Fed kept interest rates too low for too long.
All of that led to, as you know, a big boom and a big bust.
Some of us were writing back then, guys, this is absurd. This can't happen. It's going to end in tears.
So we failed to regulate the most important part of our financial system.
And I don't think any of us who've ever worked at the Fed take any comfort from the fact that somebody screwed up. But it's important we recognize there were some big mistakes made.
Didn't the Federal Reserve system fail?
I know my time has run out, but I really fundamentally disagree with your point of view.
And I think there is a natural inclination that things are fixed, but things are not fixed.
Printing money doesn't produce goods and services. It doesn't hire people. It may seem like the right short-term medicine, but can the cure be worse than the disease in some cases?
You know, the way a healthy economy grows is people earn money and they go out and spend it. The way an unhealthy economy grows is people borrow money and they go out and spend it.
The United States has consumed more than it's produced for at least a decade. What country, ask yourself, in history can do that indefinitely, forever.
Everybody wants to go back and say, things are fine now. Look, we solved our problem. We're just asking for another crisis.
This is an experiment. We've never done this before. We've never been here before. The Federal Reserve is really operating by the seat of their pants.
You have what degree of confidence in your ability to control this?
100%.
How can the dollar be anything except the world's greatest monetary brand, the Coca-Cola of money? How could it be anything else but? Well, you just watch.
So like I said, Jim Bruce will be here in the next couple of weeks. He is the editor, writer, co-producer, also of Sierra Leone's Refugee All Size, a finalist in the 2006 International Documentary Association Film Feature of the Year. And he's worked on all sorts of other things as well. And this is going to be interesting. I'm very excited to see to talk to him. And this is going to be a good discussion. Money for Nothing Inside the Federal Reserve. That's going to be coming up in a couple of weeks. We also have something else that is going to be coming up. An interesting discussion. We're really going to focus in on finances and money and talking to your kids about them, teaching them the right way to spend, not to spend, how much debt or not debt to accumulate over time. And we're going to actually have a special guest on, and this is interesting. It's Dave Ramsey's daughter, and her name is Rachel Cruz. And let's listen a little bit about her. This is a little bit of a preview about some of the things we're going to talk about, and hopefully she'll be talking about the basic principles of money. You can also have your kids send questions in before the show, but she'll be coming on next couple of weeks, listening to some of the things she has to say.
Growing up as Dave Ramsey's daughter, I learned the basics about money, this foundation. But what I've realized the older I've gotten is that money isn't just about money. Money is about life. It intertwines in every area of our life, our relationships, our marriage, with our kids. And it affects so much if you don't know how to handle it properly. And getting to travel and speak, it's not about airplanes and standing on stages. It's about being face to face with people who need this message. When I go and speak, you know, I see a young family with a little kid in the audience, and I think, gosh, I was that little girl. Because when I was 6 months old, my parents filed for bankruptcy. And I look and I see these parents starting to talk about money and see the hope in their eyes that they can do something different and that their little girl's life is going to be different because of the decisions they're going to start making about money. Or I'm looking at this newlywed couple and they're just starting out their lives and I just think, oh, if you can just listen and implement these principles, your marriage, you're going to have a level of unity unlike anyone else that you know. I'll see the college student who's overwhelmed with debt and giving them a plan to get out of that and be free of the bondage of student loan payments. One of my favorite parts about speaking is after the event, going down and interacting with people. You know, some people have just celebrated a victory when it comes to their money, but others, they're just now finding hope. They don't have to keep making the mistakes that they've been making. And seeing that is so exciting because I think, you know, it's not just them that's going to be changed. It's going to be their family. It's going to be others around them. This will change people's family tree forever. When people capture hope and they see the light at the end of the tunnel and they know that they can do this, that they can begin this journey and that they can go out and win, it's contagious and you can feel that on them. Giving people hope in this area of life, it ignites something in them. There's this fire that burns with them that says, gosh, I get to do this with my own life, but ultimately I'm doing this for the better life of my family and for others. Because I believe when you live like no one else, you get to give like no one else. So that's what I've realized about money. It's never just about money. It's more about life.
I'm looking forward to having Rachel on because it's always a good time to talk about money and bringing that information about finance to your kids. Never too early, really, if you think about it. Well, listen, when I was growing up, I remember that it was kind of a secret. You didn't really talk about money very much in the house, right? There was some discussion here and there, and we talked a little bit about it, but really understanding the intertwinings, it took me, I think my dad really started talking to me only when I was about maybe 13, 14, 15 years old. I mean, you didn't really talk about it as a young age. It was taboo. I don't know how you deal with it with your family, but you know what? How are your kids going to learn about what to do and the right and wrong thing and ingrain it into their system in terms of savings and the importance of putting away something, not spending all your money, not getting into too much debt and all that? Very, very basic discussion about the financial process when it comes to living, because we all know that we can't rely on anyone else but ourselves, unless maybe there's a big inheritance out there. And aside from that, you still can't always be guaranteed that that's going to work in your favor either. As people are living longer, let's be honest, what's happening? We see it all the time. They are planning to retire at maybe, I don't know, 65 and 70. The old days was 55 or so. They're living a lot longer. And what happens? Well, they're running out of money. It doesn't matter how quality of a money manager or investment plan you have. The fact of the matter is it's still a very tough process to make sure to have all the investment money that you need, and including all pensions and profit sharing plans and Social Security working with you in order to make sure that you have enough money to last another 20 years. It used to be that we only had a plan for, let's say, when you retire at 65, you'll last, quote-unquote last, you'll live for 15 years or so. Now you got a plan into your 90s and closer to 100 to make sure. So either you have enough money or you don't use a lot of money over the time period when you retire until the time period when you pass. And you know, you may want to even pass some money on to your kids. So all this, I think, is really important in this discussion we're going to have with Rachel Cruze coming up in the next couple of weeks. Okay? So we have Rachel coming on, we have Das coming on, Jim Bruce, the director, and plenty of other things. So I want to go into a discussion now about what happened. A lot of questions came in about, hey, what exactly is going on with the ECB, with the decision of what they did? And I thought we'd kind of hear from Draghi first in the press conference, what it is and his comments and statement in what they are actually doing, and then break that down a little bit and talk about the reaction in the markets, which was really interesting, I think, in terms of the result that we saw the day and the day after when it came to the euro, which really we do know that some of the things that should have happened was to break down the value of the euro from where it was. And we knew there was a lot of short sellers on the side of thinking that Draghi was, in fact, going to do something very historic. And they got it. But yet, if you look at the chart on a short-term basis, maybe a 30-minute chart, right after the announcement came out and the press conference, the euro did in fact go down. But throughout the day, on Thursday and into Friday, it started climbing again. Let's listen to Mario Draghi first, and then we'll talk about what's going on.
Ladies and gentlemen, Vice President and I are very pleased to welcome you to our press conference. We'll now report on the outcome of today's meeting of the Governing Council, which was also attended by the Commission Vice President, Mr. Rehn. In pursuing our price stability mandate today, we decided on a combination of measures to provide additional monetary policy accommodation and to support lending to the real economy. This package includes further reductions in the key ECB interest rates, targeted longer-term refinancing operations, preparatory work related to outright purchases of asset-backed securities, and a prolongation of the fixed-rate full allotment tender procedures. In addition, we have decided to suspend the weekly fine-tuning operation sterilizing liquidity injected under the securities market program. The decisions are based on our economic analysis, taking into account the latest macroeconomic projections by the Eurosystem staff and the signals coming from the monetary analysis. Together, the measures will contribute to a return of inflation rates to levels closer to 2%. Inflation expectations for the euro area over the medium to long term.
So basically, what does this mean? Well, probably the most important components of what Mario Draghi said and the ECB decided was, first of all, to go to a negative deposit rate. They moved to a 0.1% negative, meaning that 10 basis points. If, in fact, money is left at the ECB on behalf of banks on deposit with the excess reserves that they have, because banks are required to keep money in excess reserves of some level, but yet at the same time they may keep an entirely large amount because they're not lending, or they figure, hey, you know what, we have this money there and we're going to make a little money, or at least not lose money. It's guaranteed by the central bank. Same thing here in the U.S. and around the world. But the ECB is guaranteeing the fact that the money that is on deposit will be safe and secure. And what happens is that sometimes the banks will use that as an excuse because they know they're not going to lose money. It doesn't give them a prompt to actually put the money to work out on the street in the form of loans or other investments. And now the hope is that this will prompt the banks and position them to really push them into lending, to lend to corporations, to lend to individuals for maybe property or whatever else for enhancement of consumer credit, and therefore entitle cause inflation to move higher because much, much more money is in the system. Now, it's interesting because if you think about it, now banks have to make a decision. Well, do we suck up and pay the 0.1% and lose money, and therefore there's money that will be shown as a loss and therefore the earnings will go down overall? Or will they go out and actually move this money into a much different level of risk where maybe they have some mortgage-backed or some kind of asset-backed protection in the form of whether it's a house or a car or some other kind of personal property that will be put up involved in the loan? And if so, while they have to do a good job at, in fact, adjusting the assumptions to make sure that they can get paid. And if they don't, of course, it's a loss. So now what they have to do is say, well, will we take the 4 or 5% income from that, which is much higher, by the way, to take the risk from there to from a 0% that you get at the central bank and then push it out into the street and lend it. What's interesting about what happened was that if you think about it just for a second, what they didn't do was they didn't talk about and they didn't implement any asset-backed security purchases. They kept that on the table. They talked about that was a consideration. And here's the beauty. Here's the stick that they're dangling in front of the banks. Hey, here's the deal. We haven't done it, but we are considering it. So you know what? You might as well lend the money because if worse comes to worse, if stuff goes to crapola, you know what? We'll implement an asset-backed buying program just like the Fed did and maybe buy those assets off of you. It's really kind of funny. Really what they're doing is trying to push it out there, telling the banks they're safe if they do so, not actually doing the buys yet, but holding that off sometime in the future to hold in their back pocket. So in the event that things go bad, they can be there to the rescue. Really kind of interesting. And why not, you know, have a celebration in the markets for that? Because what you did was just create your own market. The ECB just created the ability for the banks to make more money, to actually put more money out there for consumers and for companies. And in a way, very wink, wink, say that we will be there in the future if things don't go well. Wow. Talk about an inability for any of these economies to function normally. It's pretty crazy. I mean, on one hand, you want to believe that, wow, this is such a great thing, and this is just fantastic. Because what this does is it really does change the dynamic for inflation and push inflation up and all. Really, what this ends up doing is it's a giant experiment, and if it fails, they're there to catch you anyway. As I said with Frank Kerzio last week, it's like having all these chips on your table and you going out and playing blackjack. And if you lose, hey, don't worry about it. We'll keep on funding you somehow or the other. That's what the ECB is basically telling the banks in Europe. Now, we did see that the European bond prices did hit record lows in many of the peripheral countries, which is fascinating because you saw record low yields, meaning that people were buying up their bonds like crazy with the assumption that the ECB will be there under all circumstances, which is what he said. And you're seeing that they're buying up the banks and all that, but the euro didn't budge. It didn't budge at all, which is one of the big issues right now because exports are starting to soften in Germany, and you're seeing that there is a change in the dynamic of the deflation-inflation environment. And while they talk about that they're really targeting a 2% inflation rate, which is really interesting that the world has to have, everything the U.S. has, the world seems to have. When our Fed says 2%, well, everybody else, oh, 2%, that's what we're going to go for, 2% inflation rate. Where'd that money come from? Where'd that number come from? It's probably a number that the ECB and the Fed doesn't think is possible, so they continue pumping money in. And if it changes, well, maybe they'll let it slide for a while anyway. Just like what happened when the employment number in the U.S. went below the 6.5 level, which was the first target to stop bond purchases, and there was a change of the central bank's policy down to 5.5% as a target rather than the 6.5%, just change that target when it needs to be. So the credibility of the Fed on one hand is damaged, and the ECB is probably damaged dramatically because traders and investors don't take them at all seriously. On the other hand, their credibility is such that they are so wimpy that they will do whatever it takes to pander to the markets, and they will do just like, listen, when Janet Yellen said that, well, interest rates will rise probably about 6 months after the end of the purchase program that we have, the quantitative easing program, which should end at the end of 2014. And she said the word 6 months and the markets freaked out. And then 3 days later came, well, I didn't really mean that. I meant that some extended time for an extended period. We are going on, what, 7 years? 7 years of incredibly loose monetary policy here. That is just amazing. The economy in the past, when it was at the same level we are at now, with the same kind of interest rates and same kind of unemployment rates, same kind of manufacturing, same GDP, do you know that we would not be anywhere near a zero-bound interest rate and a bond-buying program? Does this mean we're going to overheat? I will bet you dollars to donuts, I told you, and it is starting to happen, that inflation will pick up and then it will get out of control. Because what will happen is then the threat of an increasing interest rate will get people off of their duff and actually going out even quicker to go, in fact, and go buy things like a new home, potentially, or a car, because they're concerned. Look what happened in Japan just last week. The inflation was the highest it's been in, I don't know, 19 years or so. We saw that the retail sales went off the charts when there was a tax coming in. We saw that their industrial production and all the numbers right up until the tax came on just went crazy. Right afterwards, it dropped off a cliff, of course. But these kind of moves, which I've been talking about for a long time, of making interest rates a bit higher, not keeping them artificially low, will actually move investors, move individuals, consumers, and companies to do something much quicker, because if they know that interest rates will be coming down, that is the very nature of deflation. The very nature of the concept of, hey, we don't want deflation, because in any lower interest rate environment and a lower price environment, what happens is that individuals will postpone investment in goods, expansion of companies, and what happens is that you can get a deflationary spiral. So the Fed needs to somehow figure out a way to balance all of this. Now, maybe when they finish up the bond buying program, if they ever finish up the bond buying program through the end of 2014, maybe there will be a pickup at that point, and maybe we could see some inflation picking up and people starting to get concerned, because right now the complacency in terms of consumers, investors, companies is at a ridiculous level. In fact, when you look at complacency, let's talk about this for a second. We saw that the VIX hit a 9-year low just on Friday. It closed in below 11. In fact, it closed at $10.73. Not back until looking back to 2007 did we see this kind of low level of the VIX. Now, there may be other factors that are promoting this. There may be other ideas, a little bit different situation right now. But still, when you look at the VIX itself, it's not the standalone only place that you want to look for what's going on in markets. You want to look at, you know, the advanced decline line. You want to look at the trend. You want to look at like a Z-score of the 200-day moving average. There's a lot of things you want to look at where markets are. You want to look at the P/E ratio and the expansion. You want to see the prices of the stocks above their 200-day. Right now, in fact, I was looking, the S&P 500, when you look at that, we're seeing that 73 stocks are below their 200-day moving average on the S&P 500, and that's pretty low. In fact, we haven't seen that level of stocks below, or said another way, about 430 or a little bit less stocks are above their 200-day moving average, and that has popped up very dramatically of late, as we've seen that there has been a continual rally, this rally that has gone on for the last few weeks ahead of the ECB. Now, in fact, what's really interesting is that when you look at the ECB and what they did and the reaction, that you didn't see the dollar euro combination there go into a crazy decline, or the dollar come up. It's still testament to the fact that the dollar is still looking at being weaker. This is in the face of a strong employment report that we saw, a better than expected manufacturing number overall, pretty much close, and ISM services number. And what's really interesting is the dollar still hasn't moved. Bonds have not really sold off, a little bit last week, but not that much. They're still being bought as well. Where is the money coming from? This takes us all the way back to what we talked about with, well, maybe a lot of the money is from things like the banks and the sovereign funds and the investment funds of many of the banks in Europe that maybe are saying, hey, you know what? We have to take our money out. We know that the Fed in Europe, the ECB, is going to be going negative. And where are we going to put our money? So maybe what they're doing is simply taking their money and putting it into U.S.-based bonds, the treasuries. They get 2.5% on the 10-year or so. Why not do it if they can? That makes a lot of sense. That's a good explanation, because it doesn't make any sense otherwise why bonds are being bought the way they are, with the stock market at a record high on the Dow Jones and on the S&P. It makes no sense at all if you really think about it, because why would bonds be being bought, you know, otherwise? If things are so good here in the U.S., you would think that maybe bond prices should be going up. If, in fact, we know that the Fed is taking their foot off the pedal and they're starting to slow down each and every month with their bond purchases, why would the bonds being purchased? Why are we seeing this kind of a massive move into junk bonds, into treasuries, into corporates? We're seeing record issue of corporate bonds, but yet the liquidity is there on some ways in terms of the bonds, but it's being gulped up and kind of consumed as soon as they come out. So it's very interesting that we are seeing this, and it only goes to play with the fact that there is excess liquidity, even though some of it's coming out, but from places around the world. And take your pick on where you want to invest. You know, you're still seeing that the investment into European bonds, U.S. bonds, look at Japanese bonds and their rates, where they're at record low levels for the most part. I think it's a testament to the fact that there is so much money out there. And it really doesn't talk about the equity markets much, because it's a whole different animal. But that does a bit help us with an explanation of what's going on with the bonds. Now, how is everybody so wrong? I mean, you look at the end of last year, 2013, in the bond area, and you would have thought, hey, this is a no-brainer. Let's just short the long bond. And we know that interest rates are going up because the Fed has basically told us that interest rates are going to go up. They said they're going to slow down buying bonds. And that, by its very nature, means that the bond prices should drop. There's not that incremental buyer right there. And we know that yields will do the opposite, and yields should start moving higher. And that happened at the end of 2013, and then reversed entirely, let's call it, in February. So what was happening there? What is happening? How are so many people wrong about this? I mean, really, if you took a survey of any investor out there, it was like a no-brainer. But the one big difference was that, again, the stock market started to move higher as well. That's where the whole thinking about this got strange, where you saw that the bond market and the stock market were climbing together post-February. That's, I think, where the whole thing got really out of whack. Whereas the traders who thought and bet and maybe hedged out their positions in the bond area, looked at this and said, okay, you know what, we got these bonds, we're going to hedge them. Or some people came out as a direct short. That didn't work so well. And yield investments, anything that has some kind of yield, have done incredibly well. Listen to this for a second. Think about real estate investments, REITs, that are high dividend paying. So, for example, the iShares Dow Jones Real Estate Index, it's an ETF with the symbol IYR, up 15.5% this year, has a 3.5% yield on it, which obviously has come down a bit because of the incredible price move that we've seen here. You look at a one-year basis, we're talking about a little bit less. It dropped down a bit, but over 5 years, up 100% over that period of time. This thing doubled over that period of time. Pretty impressive. And when you look at all of the REITs that are involved in this area in terms of real estate, you'll see some pretty impressive numbers. I mean, it really has been a remarkable run when it comes to not only real estate, but it comes to the investments that have yield. And I think that really says a lot about what's going on here, is that there's a, on one hand, a flight to safety, not a, a panic move, because you see that in gold, et cetera. We're not seeing that. But a flight to safety in terms of the yield and the backing of those companies that have a high interest rate that can give us a bottom line backup of this. And then on top of it, we have the fact that bonds are being bought as well. So I think those two things show us there's a flight for safety or yield, but not a panic. That's why, going back to the VIX, you're seeing that at about 1073 right now. There's just no panic. It's a very orderly process right now. And I think that when it comes to this complacency, it may not be entirely the same situation going on with the VIX that we've seen before. Now, I think that the VIX itself has something to be said about markets, but there was an interesting conversation with John Malloy over at the CEO of StockTwits on Bloomberg TV about a week ago, talking about how maybe there's something different here and it's not as important to look at least right now. Now, this does bring up the, well, this time is different concept, which is never the same, but yet, take a listen.
Well, I think you guys hit on it with the VIX here, and I think that people got a lot real worried when it went below 12, okay? That was the magic number, because that's been the number that's triggered sell-offs in the past. But when we saw the VIX go below 12 this time, I think it's a different looking VIX. I think the VIX has become too popular, too many people are watching it. And Adam touched on it as well. I think that the big banks aren't in there trading this thing anymore. You've got ETF products like the VXX that are off it. I think the VIX is no longer a reliable indicator.
That's very interesting. You know, when you see that already, when we're looking at the forward valuations and the rolling valuations of the VIX options, you take the 11s, 12s, 13s, all the way up to maybe, let's say, 20, and you put them out 1 month in advance. What's the pricing on this? There is an amazing amount of contango going on. That's the problem with some of these ETF devices, if you hold on to for too long. And we learned a lesson on that not too long ago. Obviously, you can get into that situation where you're kind of looking for the VIX to move up, and you're scratching your head and say, wait a minute, how come these various VIX ETFs are just not doing it? You know, they're not going along with where the market is. A lot of reasons for that. One of them happens to be that you're looking at a product that's looking at the short-term VIX. But the second thing is that if you look at the outward view of what happens if they have to keep on buying the VIX on a regular basis, you'll notice that, generally speaking, right now, the current environment and the current structure of the VIX out into the future, with the idea that it will rise sometime in the future, is putting pressure on these products, because they will have a natural degradation of about 1% a day, 0.5% a day. So you need the VIX to really pop significantly higher for this thing to really make some serious move. Now, we are seeing it at a pretty low level right now. I don't know if I would trust the VIX as an identifier of market trend right now, but keep your eye on it, because if you do look at a chart historically, and when you do see these very big breaks up and directionally trending higher, like on a parabolic move up or down, you do see that those do turn around. And I'm not suggesting that that's going to happen right away, because it may be a little bit of a slightly different environment right now because of the coverage and where the investors are utilizing the VIX and what product. But the complacency is clearly there. You see that the bullish sentiment of newsletter writers and individuals is very, very high. You see that there is a buy the dip that happens intraday on a regular basis in every scenario, and end of day pop towards the end of the day into the last half hour. These are all bullish signs. And the VIX being at the level that it is also a bullish sign. But yet, at the same time, it's one of those things that needs you to keep your eyes kind of and your ears perked up for what's the thing that we don't know at this point that could happen. I wanted to get in discussion a little bit for a moment, and then we'll come back to some other ideas of what's happening in the next week in terms of the economics. Very light week overall. In fact, when you look at next week, we're going to be seeing that the wholesale trade inventories, wholesale inventories and trade numbers coming out on the 10th. We're going to see retail sales. Now, retail sales have been very interesting. Last month, the advanced month-over-month retail sales looked as though there was about a 0.1% gain. This month, we're looking for a 0.6 gain, a very, very significant increase on a month-over-month basis. Now, when you take out things like auto and gas, looking at a negative 0.1 that was last month and looking at a 0.4% increase this month. So definitely looking for a much more significant increase. But other than that, You're going to see that PPI is coming out at the end of this week. We're going to be showing supposedly a final demand month over month of a 0.1%. And it was, if you remember last month, it was pretty high. We saw a 0.6% increase last month. Now we're going to say it's going to drop significantly, which I find really interesting. Although the year over year is going to be still pointing higher at a 2.4% versus a 2.1% that was last period. If you take out food and energy, it's still over 2%. And then University of Michigan Confidence Index is expected to jump to 83.1 from a final reading last month of 81.9. That's going to be on the 13th. Friday the 13th, we're going to be seeing that. So far, the whole adage of sell them and go away is just not playing out. You know, when you have central banks so involved in micromanaging, which they don't usually do, they look at it from a long-term view, but it looks like they're almost involved in this on a daily basis and a coordinated basis around the world. This is what you get. So let's talk about maybe some stocks and some things to kind of be aware of. We did see that on Friday after the close that there was an announcement by the Icon Group there that he's taking a big piece of Family Dollar. Now, what you want to look at is all the other companies in that area as well, like a Dollar General, a Five Below, and see what happens and how these play out. After the close, when the announcement came out, I think there was about a 6 or 7% jump on Family Dollar. Now, some of the companies that are related to this, you have, for example, Dollar General, which is symbol DG, Dollar Tree Stores, DLTR, Big Lots, BIG, Five Below, symbol FIVE. There may be a few others that are related, but these are the core ones that I think you really want to look at and see how they react to this. If, in fact, Carl Icahn is coming in as a major player, holding about close to a 10% stake, about 9.5% stake, and looking to do a variety of things when it comes to the company. He's looking to possibly do some board positioning, and he's looking to do some kind of work to help this company along. Obviously, it's not seen a great year this year, so obviously him coming in as he does, looking at the overall trend down about 6.5% this year on a one-year basis. The company is down very much flat, actually. But he sees some kind of opportunity here, and he's going to be looking to boost the value of this and talks with the company itself. And obviously, when Carl Icahn pops in, there is always a seemingly a pretty good move on a stock initially, and hopefully that he will be able to do so. Now, you're seeing that there's a lot of not only M&A that goes on throughout the various industries right now, where we're seeing the healthcare industry do a lot, some technology as well. But you're also seeing that there is a good amount of activist investor work that's being done as well that we're finding in this market. Now, some of that has to do with the fact that you have very low rates. And again, it's like the days of the LBOs, where you saw that there was a tremendous amount of opportunity that was made involved in doing some leveraged buyouts when there was interest rates that were applicable and there was some opportunity there, and we'll see how this plays out. But this is also going to be, you know, involved with the whole idea that there's a lot less liquidity on the markets right now due to the fact that buybacks are really, you know, kicking in pretty well. And you're seeing that companies are offering more and more in terms of dividends. And then you have these activists that are coming in and doing things to either try to, bring companies together, bring more value, increase the buybacks, increase the share distributions. I mean, don't forget what Icahn pressured, and whether it worked or not, we don't exactly know, but pressured Apple to do massive buybacks and distributions of their incredible amount of money they had, as well as some acquisitions. And while Icahn was not at all happy with the acquisition of Beats, due to the fact that he would rather the money be returned to shareholders, thinking that that's a better play for him short-term at least than it is for them to try to get into a different industry and to absorb this. You're still seeing there's a tremendous appetite for any kind of new and change in terms of companies. Look at the IPO market. We saw that Uber, which is the it's a very controversial, we'll call it car service / alternative to taxis that allows for a new entry into the markets. And there's a big hoo-ha when it comes to the taxi unions, taxi service companies around the world, particularly in the UK and in the US and some of the metropolitan areas. But with the recent IPO value that they're looking at and what they're looking to come up with in the pricing, the company is currently valued about $17 billion. That is enormous. absolutely enormous. Looks like they're going to come out with about 10% of the shares, so a relatively small float initially, which would obviously do well to boost up the share value. But I don't know what you think about this, but and if you've used Uber and if you like it, but there is going to be a tremendous fallout when it comes to Uber and the yellow cabs, if you will, or the official taxi cabs of any city around the country, because this is going to break the whole mode and technically break the monopoly on various cities and services. But it reminds me of like a Huizenga move, like what Wayne Huizenga did with several companies, whether it was Blockbuster, Waste Management, AutoNation, et cetera. Companies where there was there was many players in a market, and many of them may have been individually successful and profitable. But he took those and consolidated, the whole idea of consolidating an industry. Now, Uber is not essentially a consolidation of the taxi industry, because it's a bit different than that, but it is a challenge to the taxi industry. It is a direct, I guess we would call it an innovation and a disruption in the current state of business when it comes to taxis. Now, it may be more expensive, but there are a few other things in there that a lot of people who want to use a private car service or an alternative to a taxi for short-term move in terms of intra-city or throughout an area that they like in terms of how Uber operates and the safety and some of the things that are involved there. Now, I am looking forward to seeing the fireworks and the fallout when it comes down to how cities are going to regulate this and where the political boundaries are going to lie when it comes to this. I think it's kind of fascinating. You know, you're already seeing some of this. For example, look at companies like Airbnb and HomeAway and VRBO. You know, one of the big things that happened is that investors bought up properties and then put them out there as rental properties. And the problem was that they were going against the hotels. Right now, you can rent maybe for a week or 2 weeks and short term rentals. And all of a sudden, the hotels got just nuts about it. And there's going to be taxation. There's going to be regulation potentially. And there's all sorts of problems in this area. This is one example of a disruptive technology / industry move and a change to the industry that is hurting the traditional. And when you look at the politics behind all of this, you know, it's going to be very interesting how that plays out, because it's still very up in the air when it comes to, you know, getting the potential for now you have to pay sales tax and short-term hotel rates potentially for short-term stays. And that's going to be a problem maybe for the people who are looking for vacation homes. And it's going to be very satisfactory because it's going to put on a bit of an even playing field for the hotels. Now, mind you, and let's be honest about this, the fact that you're staying in someone's home, you don't usually get, for example, the various services for the most part. You're not going to get the maid service. You're not going to have room service. You're not going to have someone at a front desk. Much different character and much different scenario. But yet, this is something that is challenging the hotels and the various city taxes and the hotel taxes and the bed taxes. And that is not being paid. And therefore, the various cities want to have this. So they're going to side with the hotels in this for the most part because they want to collect their money on this. And what we're going to see with Uber in terms of how that's going to play out is going to be interesting. It's like Amazon. Listen, Amazon didn't have the problem of paying sales tax, or the individuals buying from Amazon didn't have the problem of sales tax for a long time, and now they do. We can see what's happening in the states that are, in fact, charging sales tax on Amazon goods. Florida just came on a couple months ago. They're actually seeing a drop in their sales, Amazon is. And what's interesting is that if you think about that, people are saying, you know what, if I could get the same thing now at the store and Amazon for the same price, the convenience of next day service maybe from Amazon Prime is great, but I could just stop by and get the same thing right now. Whereas I was not only saving some money, but also saving a ton of money in taxes before. Well, that's not the case. So it's a very interesting evolution of what's happened. It's similar. It reminds me of what happened when you first had computers come out. You had dummy terminals. And then you went into having just dummy terminal and a server all the way back to the PC. And now we're back to cloud, which is the same thing as a dummy terminal. We're 100% reversed again. think about it, for the most part, you have some things on your PC, but a lot of cloud and cloud pushing. When you have like a Salesforce as a software as a service, and Adobe, et cetera, you don't have that stuff on your machines as much as you would, and you have a lot more connective and connectivity to the cloud in terms of your email, et cetera. This is really taking an about turn from where we were. Same thing when it comes to the benefits that were from Amazon, from the brick and mortar, and the benefit and the advantage back to brick and mortar. Very fascinating process overall, and you'll see that this is going to happen in many industries where you kind of have the advent of something brand new and the change in the dynamic, and you're not going to have the industry, the base industry that was the prior and the originator, go out without a fight. I mean, it's just not going to happen. So this is going to be an interesting evolution to watch when it comes to what happens with Uber, vacation rentals, etc., and how this is all going to play out into the future. In terms of earnings next week, very little earnings, not much really to speak of. I think the big issue is going to be how, in fact, we see markets react and the incredible moves that will be made and maybe absorbed, and looking at the euro, how, in fact, that will react to all of this. We did see that China's numbers. We saw that import-export numbers came out over the weekend, and their import numbers were pretty lousy. And that probably has to do a lot with the fact that they let their currency get devalued or lower. They allowed it to stop rising. They did see a pretty good level of exports. That was good to see. And whether or not we could trust it's another discussion, but the imports really fell off. That does, in fact, tie out with a weaker currency scenario. So that's good for them. In fact, that there is a weaker currency, it does play out, as we talked about a moment ago, with regard to the PPI and the final numbers in terms of the cost factors, because if we get cheaper exports from them, right, if we're still using the same amount of exports and they're cheaper because their currency is down, that benefits our suppliers and manufacturers here in the U.S. that are using those. So I think that's really the big play that's going to happen. I'm also really, really interested in watching what's going to happen with Japan over the next few months, because I just don't see that with all of the other stimulus that's being pumped in around the world, how Japan, who really threw in the kitchen sink, now is going to compete against Europe and their whole plan, and whether or not we're finally going to see a reaction by markets in the face of potentially some significant amount of inflation. Watch gold and silver, who have each of those really have not been doing much, did drop recently, but not been doing much in the face of all this excess amount of liquidity from the ECB. Dropped below 1,300 on gold and stayed below there for some time now and trading a little technically within a band. I would like to see what happens with that play moving forward. I think it's going to be something very interesting. We're going to end it right here on a good note, as they say. Of course, you could write me anytime, askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check out the Arrow strategy that we have, because we do manage money. I have some things I want to tell you in the next few weeks about some things that we have coming up, finally able to go with the global allocations potentially for you at a much lower entry point from our 500,000 traditional minimum due to the fact that we redesigned it a little bit for you. And a great guest coming up, as I mentioned, Rachel Cruz, Jim Bruce, as well as Das. Well, thanks for joining me, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.